Welcome to the post-correction phase of the Planetary Tantra Talks. And with the main Turton, John Lash, in mega high gear as we navigate with the Wisdom Goddess, please let this passage from the Nag Hammadi Codices sink deeply into your consciousness. When Pistis saw the impiety of the Lord Archon, she was filled with anger. Acting in her invisible form, she spoke in this way: "You are mistaken, blind one, false deity who cannot see. There is an immortal, luminous child, the Anthropos, who came into existence before you, and who will appear among your mottled forms. This luminous child will trample you in scorn, just as a potter's clay is pounded into a lump. And you will sink away to your proper zone, the abyss of gravity, along with those who belong to your legion. For at the consummation of your work, the entire defect of archontic illusion, exposed in the light of truth, will be abolished, and that illusion will be as if never had been. On the Origin of the World." Okay, and welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 14. It is August the 29th. We are right in the middle of a new moon, which means we are coming to the close of the Bayadavi shift. And I welcome you, John, to the talk tonight. And I would like to start out asking you, are we going to be seeing a double shift of Bayadavi? Or if not, when will we know what is upcoming?
Well, we're all of us who follow this process anyway, living in intense suspense, I could say. I won't be able to call it until, the crescent moon will appear Wednesday evening. I'll be able to observe it then. I wouldn't be able to call it probably till Friday. So in the next talk, we're going to do a couple more or one more this week. I will be able to say... you know, if it's Bhairavi, if it's a second shift, or if it goes to the next Dakini, which would be Shodashi.
Shodashi, okay. Well, part of me hopes that we do a double shift, just because it would be appropriate for some of the things that are coming up, some of the projects that are lined up. But I tell you, it's like you noted in one of your notes on the Dakinis on Metta History, that it's like climbing out of a train wreck. And I think I know exactly how you feel when you wrote that.
Well, you know, Thomas, you're a pretty ferocious character. I mean, sometimes I think you may be too ferocious for your own good. And anybody who's asking for a second Bhairavi shift has got to be a reckless dude, okay? So yeah. I'm going to give you a piece of advice here, okay? Just to, like, okay, put you in your place, man. There's an ancient, not an ancient, but there's a medieval saying from the lore of the warriors of Japan, and it goes like this: the samurai picks his teeth even when he's had nothing to eat. So bear that in mind while you're waiting for the second Bhairavi shift.
All right. Well, I'm sitting here on the table with a newly arrived book on the samurai sword that was actually ordered before you had tied the Bhairavi and Shimamukha together into the image of the samurai sword. So I think it's quite appropriate that I've received that today.
It certainly is. The anger, sacred anger, which comes under the shift of Bhairavi and under the direction of Bhairavi, is like a samurai sword and must be used with equal skill, elegance, restraint, caution. But then at the moment it needs to be used, with no restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very appropriate to be reading about Japanese swordsmanship right now. By the way, that was a joke from a book called Japanese Humor by Blythe. You know, Blythe was the Englishman who compiled the haiku.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever see his book on Japanese humor?
On Japanese humor, no, but I'm well acquainted with some of his other books. Yeah.
Right. He compiled a bunch of jokes in a book on Japanese humor, which I have in my library, which is now in Portugal. And that's one of the lines from it. And I have to say, you know, we could dedicate a session sometime to talking about the Japanese. I read the book diligently, and I just couldn't find anything in it that was funny. So the Japanese have a very particular sense of humor, which is, well, all cultures do, of course. But theirs is particularly exotic, and so people don't always laugh at the punchline of a Japanese joke unless you're Japanese.
Well, I guess that means I'm Japanese, because even as we speak, my children are recording a Japanese comedy show that I never miss on Monday nights. So I find their humor to be the most gut-wrenching of anything, not gut-wrenching, but gut-tickling of anything out there.
Well, maybe we could dedicate a whole session to talking about that at some point. That would be very worthwhile. Anyway, let's proceed.
Yeah, let's dive into things here. We're kind of titling things here tonight, Review and Preview, because we've covered so many things here in the last few weeks that we do need to kind of slow down, look and see where we are at and where we want to go. I want to kind of start out here, not really as a piece of advice, because I think it's obvious to most people who are tied into Planetary Tantra. But the one thing I'd like to say is that we do need to be a little bit careful of how we treat the so-called alternative media. Because a lot of it, even the well-known sites out there, have become, in my mind at least, almost hijacked in a sense. That they're dealing all in fantasy and things that seem similar to Planetary Tantra, but that are really have no connection and actually are kind of derailing it. So I just like to put that out there for people to let's stay with what we can prove, what's logical, what's testable. And if you have any comments on that, John, before we dive into things, please go ahead and add some there.
Sure. My main comment would be an observation that I've often made, a proposition, a statement, call it what you will. There is no metaphysics in Planetary Tantra, and we don't need it. We don't need New Age make-believe. We don't need to talk about other dimensions. We don't need to go into hierarchical schemes and scenarios that may have been inherited or channeled from one source or another. Because the essence of this process is interactivity with the wisdom goddess herself, the divine presence of the earth, everything unfolds within that relationship. Everything unfolds within the dynamic of power sharing with the divine Sophia. We don't need any of these other systems. Planetary Tantra is not an anything goes mix and match program. It's very carefully and rigorously defined within certain guidelines. And I don't have to argue for that or play the authority or try to control anyone. It's something that becomes self-evident when you look soberly and honestly at this process. So people will discover that in their own way, or they won't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And everything that has come up in Planetary Tantra, either in the writings or in these talks or in other interviews, is it can all be tested. It's all veracious. And I guess that's kind of how I want to... The next thing I would like to go into is in the last two talks, you have brought up two separate exercises. First of all, I'd like to kind of know how should we refer to these? For example, the chiral, the breakage of the chiral lock, the release. How would you term that?
Right. I would term that the lock is broken. Sophia herself did that. She weakened and broken it massively by her own intention. So what could you call it? Let's say keeping the chiral lock open. So we'll just say that's the exercise, keeping it open, keeping the chiral lock open by this exercise of looking at your thumb and shifting from right to left eye.
Okay, and then what term would you give for the dealing with the archontic stare?
Well, that's has two purposes, by the way. I want to point out that that exercise wherein you sit with your hands and feet in the earth and you're with your fingers enfolded behind your neck has two purposes. One, that it grounds you to the earth and therefore minimizes the capture of the archontic stare upon your consciousness. So that's the two things that it does. It's just an in itself, it's just an excellent grounding exercise. And considering that the earth is going through an absolute and total upheaval of the electromagnetic configuration of the planet, and that the whole structure and the layout of the lines of the electromagnetic field, the mesh of it, is being remolded, and we are therefore moving through an unknown territory. We're moving through a bioelectromagnetic chaos. It's very good to be grounded and to ground yourself occasionally back into the earth by this exercise. And at the same time, it will help you keep free of the archontic stare. So you could call it breaking the archontic stare.
Okay. Very good. I would like to do a little bit more on that, if you allow me to kind of go slowly into what the very next day I did the breaking of the archontic stare exercise, you could say. I went out into the mountains like I usually do,
mm-hmm.
sat in what Japanese call seiza, which is where you sit on your heels.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting that the kanji for seiza, you can actually write it as quiet sitting. They usually write it as correct sitting.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I sat in that way and then, you know, let my hands dangle up down in front of me, palms down. And after a few minutes, I went into a squatted down position with my hands over the back of my neck. And I must tell you, it was the most relaxing, most immersive experience that I can remember in a very, very long time. I felt so, so involved with the energies that were flowing through the vastness of the earth below me that I just stayed in that position for 20 or 25 minutes. And I tell you, if the Buddha's enlightenment was anything more profound than this, well, he can keep it because that's all I needed. That was the most peaceful thing I've had in years. And it's an amazing thing. And I did look at my hands afterwards and they were mottled just like
is that so?
Kobe beef. Yeah.
You can test the experience and the depth you go into it. Now, this may not happen to some people. It depends on everyone is different in our physiological and electrochemical makeup, you know. And mm-hmm. some people have a quicker response than others, so it might take 4 or 5 sessions. But I'm pretty certain, I can say with confidence, that everyone who does this exercise correctly and enjoys it, you know, you don't do it out of some kind of rigor or discipline you force on yourself. You do it because it's enjoyable. The principle of Kalika practice is that our rituals are enjoyable. And everyone who does it in that way is going to see the mottling of their hands. And I'd also point out that it's a very good exercise to do in the current months and coming ahead because of this big question we're all facing about the solar madness, I'm calling it. I'm going to think of a better word here soon because I'm not sure if it should be called madness. But the solar disruption, something is happening profoundly with the sun. Some interaction between the sun and the earth is being adjusted. And during this recent month of August, regardless of whether it was the Bhairabi shift or not, a good number of people wrote to me expressing the exact same experiences. There is, on the one hand, a tremendous sense of vitiation, of being devitalized and of being morally and physically exhausted. But at the same time, within that exhaustion, there's a strange kind of tension. It's like there's a hidden flame burning deep down at the base of the wick. And and then there is a sense of exasperation. I mean, on a good day, I can be a pretty, you know, cantankerous old dog, you know. I don't take out my anger on people, or if I do, it's a rare occasion, but I generally can get peeved, and there's really a tendency to have a very short fuse. My fuse has been shorter than ever lately, over little things and not having the attention to concentrate or do anything. Numerous people have been reporting this, and I would put this down to the disruptions of the electromagnetic field of the Earth due to the massive solar coronal emissions. So I believe that this exercise of breaking the iconic stare will also help in handling those situations, because it is quite basically and simply a grounding exercise.
Indeed it is. Indeed it is. And I don't want to you know, take this too far, because we have a lot of things we want to talk about. But I do just want to mention one thing is, in reading the Buddhist Goddesses of India, she starts out talking about, you know, Buddha's awakening and how Prithivi, he touched the earth with the army sent out by Mada.
Right.
And that touching of the earth was the moment when the awakening happened. And I at first equated the army sent out by Mada as the Archons.
Right.
But then the thought hit me that actually that wouldn't really perhaps make sense, that perhaps the Archons are not intelligent enough or perceptive enough to even see something as subtle as what might be happening. So I don't know if that means anything. It's just a thought that kind of came to me when I was thinking about that.
Right. Well, I would interpret the army of Mara in that context. I mean, there's no one single definitive interpretation, but I would offer it as the delusional projections of the ego, and they are both projections, negative projections, that is to say, projections of lack of self-worth or guilt or desperation or shame, but also positive projections, you know, positive projections and grandiosity and thoughts of godhood and things like that. All of those kinds of egoic projections are the demons and army of Mara. And the beautiful lesson of that story is that by the earth touching mudra, Gautama grounded himself to the earth, and he received his enlightenment through that connection. And I would really venture to say that this moment now is the moment of the earth touching mudra for the human species, just as it was for Siddhartha some 2,500 years ago. That experience of his enlightenment happened at the exact midpoint of Kali Yuga. And we are now 2,500 years ahead in time at the end of Kali Yuga. And it feels very much to me, it looks very much to me, like this is the moment of the earth touching mudra and the enlightenment of our species. So it's a fantastic moment to be alive.
Yes, indeed. Very good. Very nice. All right, John, let's go ahead and go into some of the things we have outlined here. Let's see. So we have the practice of planetary tantra, and then we have the Gaian navigation experiment. And I think myself, I've been kind of, in a sense, equating them as a single thing, and I'm perhaps not reading this correctly. So how would we kind of, in a sense, separate these as in two different movements, and then how would we, again, once bring them together as well?
Well, it's very simple, actually, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to clarify this point. I've made some allusions to the Dakini shifts, which change every month following the new moon, in the crew notes. And there are a considerable number of people signed on to crew notes who have not previously practiced planetary tantra, as I know you, Thomas, and some others have and do. So they're not familiar with practicing and observing the lunar shaktis, as it's called. This is just a simple practice where we tune in each month at the new moon when it appears as a crescent in the west, and we tune in to the subliminal mind frequencies in order to detect a mood or theme and to listen deeply into the enlightened levels of the mind, listen past the radio of the mind that's always playing, and the self-talk and the inner monologue. Listen beyond that into the deeper frequency, and that is the practice to make a connection with Gaia, because she is transmitting to us on those frequencies. So that's a standard practice in planetary tantra. Now, not too long ago, following the event of March 19th, I proposed the Gaian Navigation Experiment, GNE, if you want to call it that. The Gaian Navigation Experiment is actually a unique experiment that stands completely on its own terms. It's something that you could only know, you could only conceive of what it is if you had a framework of planetary tantra. But it is not just the practice of planetary tantra. The Gaia Navigation Experiment is a unique opportunity that lasts for 3 years, from March 2011 to March 2014, inviting a number of people to enter intimately into the process by which the planet Earth is assuming self-propulsion and freeing itself from the capture of the solar system. And this astronomical event is a real event in the sky, and at the same time, it is a massive event in the collective psyche of humanity. And the Gaia Navigation Experiment is to see how closely we can follow this event. So it's special. It's only possible during these 3 years. And planetary tantra is an ongoing process that we will continue to practice until the end of Kali Yuga in 2216. So that's how the two can be distinguished. But of course, in real time, they're happening simultaneously.
There, that is clear, yes. And you had mentioned in a memo here that, and I'm not exactly clear of how you mean this, but you refer to a mixing shifts with navigation.
Right. Well, I've been mixing shifts with navigation. For instance, in the last month, I've been routinely alluding to Bhairavi, which is a term in the practice of planetary tantra. But some of the crew members who've signed on may not be familiar with that practice. You see what I mean? They signed on because I set out an invitation that proposed particular limits and guidelines for this experiment. Being attracted to that, they signed on. You don't have to go into the deep particulars of planetary tantra. Well, actually, it's very simple. But you don't have to necessarily be doing those to follow the Gaia Navigation Experiment. But I am absolutely convinced that those in the crew members who get on to the experiment, and how exciting it is and how fantastic it is to be able to have a voracious process of interaction with the Earth, to actually be able to test if this, we're using a metaphor that is not just a metaphor, it's a testable metaphor. So I'm going to talk about that a little later in this talk, about how this nautical metaphor is showing up all over the place. And so it's fantastic to have this process of testing this metaphor. But at the same time, the practice of planetary tantra is optional. But I think people who get into the experiment, Thomas, are going to be wanting to do planetary tantra. So they'll undertake the Gaia Tantric vow. I see this happening more and more each week. And they will look at the other simple practices in planetary tantra. It's a natural emergence of those two things.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I'm sure people will be drawn to do it. And they can either refer to what you've written or go back and listen to what we've talked about in previous talks. Very simple things. There's nothing difficult.
No.
And it's all of it is a very great pleasure to perform.
It's a pleasure to perform. And that is the secret of Calico Rites. If it's not a pleasure, we don't do it. And if it isn't a pleasure to do, it's not effective. The greater pleasure it is, the more effective it is. This is the secret of Kalika practice, that is to say, of Kali, who is the aspect of Gaia who directs and guides us in the last two centuries of the Kali Yuga.
Which ends in
2216.
Okay, got it. So that, since we're kind of reviewing things a little bit and kind of slowing down a little bit, let's go into the time frame again here of what's involved in the correction. So to VV, 10 seconds equals 3 years.
That's right.
1 second equals 108 days.
That's right.
In aeonic time.
That's right. 108 days is tremendously important. The whole tremor of Gaia Awakening was developed in 108 days. I was brought into the initiation on April 6th. By the way, on that day, I didn't know it at the time, but that's the day each year when the Earth moves into the apsides of Jupiter. Really interesting, huh?
Run that by me once more. You said you were brought into it on April 6th.
I was brought into the initiation that led to the term of Gaia Awakening on April 6th, 2008.
2008. Okay.
And at that time, I didn't realize that each year on April 6th, the Earth moves into the apsides of Jupiter.
Hmm.
Well, as we know, and as we're learning, and there's much, much more to teach you about this, my friends and my crew members, is that the correction of Sophia starts in the apsides of Jupiter. And we are going to learn, I don't say this as a prophecy, let me put it in another way. I have to be very careful about using the future tense. We are due to discover in the coming 3 years the tremendous role that Jupiter plays in relation to the Earth. And we can say that Jupiter is one of the first archontic planets of the archontic system that is going to be deeply instrumental in Gaia's correction, in Sophia's correction. You know, even though as a planet, Sophia is captured in the archontic system of the inorganic worlds, it doesn't matter because she is an aeon. And when she begins her correction, she can turn or convert every aspect of capture into an aspect of cosmical and dynamical process to her own advantage and to her own purposes and aims. And the first planet that is, in a sense, let me put it crudely, being used or employed by the Earth for her correction is Jupiter. And we're going to learn so much. I would not be surprised if some remarkable scientific information emerges very soon and over the next 3 years about the relation of Jupiter to the Earth, and particularly about extremely intimate connections between Jupiter and the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I could present a whole talk on the relationship to Jupiter and the Moon. It's something that I've explored for many years. It's something that seems to have been completely overlooked by astrologers, certainly, as well as by other people who've looked into cosmic relations or planetary relations. The interrelation between Jupiter and the Moon contains the secret of the gyroscopic balance of the mothership. The gyroscopic balance. You know that great ocean vessels, great ocean liners, have these massive gyroscopes in them. You know that.
Mm-hmm. They use for navigation, yeah.
And so we could ask ourselves, I'm going to talk a little later in this talk as we conclude about the actual structure. I'm going to give you an imaginative picture of the structure of the mothership, what she looks like, how she's formed, how she's laid out. And, of course, she has her own gyrostatic devices. And to a certain extent, her gyrostatic devices are located outside of her in the planetary system. So she uses Jupiter for part of her gyrostatic balance. And the relations between Jupiter and the Moon in terms of the cycles of those planets and the interactions of them is one of the most profound secrets of correction. So I'm going to be talking about this. And so basically, to get back to the main point that you just mentioned in the timing, I use an analogy, which is very, very simple. Most of the mathematics I do, by the way, is Mickey Mouse. If you go to Kalaman, I think that's his name, or if you go to John Major Jenkins, or if you go to Jose Arguelles, and you look at their calculations, permutations, and calendric manifestations regarding 2012 and cosmic time cycles, you're going to be as dizzy as a duck on a roller coaster.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I'm sure most of us have tried that on our own and worked with it, and it really does leave you exacerbated.
So complicated. The 13-ness, the 9-that, the cycles within cycles, the blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
blah. Well, I'm not like that. And I can assure you that every bit of mathematics and every bit of cosmic timing that I can teach you in correction is absolutely Mickey Mouse. And a 10-year-old kid could get it. Now, I'll give you an example. I use the analogy of 108 days of human time to 1 second of aeonic time. Now, where do I derive this analogy? It's very simple. If you take the precessional cycle of 25,920 years, which is the time that it takes for the precession of the equinoxes is one complete cycle of 360 degrees. Mm-hmm. And consider it to be a cosmic day, then it breaks down and compares to a day of 24 hours. And if you develop that correlation, 25,920 years is a day of 24 hours. It comes out to 1 second of that day, 1 second of that massive time frame is 108 days. It's very, very simple. 108 mm-hmm. days is a ritual that I have used to develop many things. As I said, I was initiated into the term of Gaia Awakening without knowing that I was on April 6, 2008. And 108 days later, I had the Rhonda moment.
Mm-hmm.
108 days after that, I got the secret name of VV. 108 days after that, I released the term of Gaia Awakening when I was in White Plains, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to ask you to come into these arcane processes with me, but I will ask you to observe one thing as members of the crew, and that is that get into your mind. In fact, sit back quietly, sit back in a chair, take it easy, and take 5 minutes to contemplate this. The next 3 years of your life is 10 seconds of hers.
Mm-hmm.
Just take that on board. 10 seconds. She achieves correction in 10 seconds, which is 10 times 108 days, which is 1,080 days, which is about 3 years. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Got it. Very interesting. And just one thing I wanted to ask you before I lose track of that is, have you actually written about the initiation on April 6th on Meta History?
Well, yeah, I've talked about it here and there, you know, Thomas. If you go look into Planetary Tantra, you know, you'll hear about the story of Emma. And now I had this massive emotional, romantic, sexual, emotional trauma. Then I didn't know what it was. It was a big shock that hit me. And then when I went up to an Infinity Ridge one day in June of 2008, when I was staggering from this this emotional trauma, this drama that I was in, Kali, in her soft and sensitive manner,
she bit you on the forehead.
She hit me in the forehead. She strikes like a serpent sometimes, and it's like being hit by a freight train. And she said, "No, man, this is not some, you know, emotional drama that you're living through because this woman dumped you. This is a major tantric initiation, and you better pay attention to where it's taking you." And so that's when I started to ritualize it and treat it as an initiation process connected directly to the Rakinis and to Gaia. And I was drawn immediately into the power of the Divine Sophia, and that's when I received the term of Gaia Awakening on 8-8-08. So, this process of 1 second at a time is extremely valuable. It's not just a game, folks. I'm inviting you to test it out. And you'll find that there's a certain suspense. We are in great suspense, aren't we, Thomas? Would you agree this is an intensely suspenseful process?
Well, yeah. Obviously it is.
It's overwhelming. At moments, it's overwhelmingly suspenseful. Why is because that is the natural thing that a small creature, such as a human being, is going to feel when you're integrated into the life field of an enormous creature like the planet. That its life forces are like massive tides. Her emotions, her moods, her thoughts are massive tides that shift through the sky, that shift through the very earth that you're walking on and erupt and vibrate out of the depths of the earth. And when you attune yourself to that, when you give your consent, that you're willing to feel that and be interactive with her, it becomes tremendously suspenseful because you are, in fact, living in human time 108 days, but it's only a second for her. And to live in that contrast hones your awareness in the way that a sorcerer likes.
Mm. I like the way you said that. Indeed.
And you know it's true because you're doing it, and you know how easily it comes to you. We don't ever strain. I want to say this to people who are coming into Planetary Tantra, as well as to those crew members who are listening to this talk. Don't ever strain. Don't ever strain anything. There's no strain in this process. This process is designed to access you to the absolute optimum of your human potential and to bring you to the threshold of the supernatural and into the supernatural. And it will do it all on its own particular currents. All you have to do is be observant and stay with the process. And when you know you're with the process, there's always one sign. And you know what this is, Thomas, and other people as well, such as Holly, have commented. You feel overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You feel overwhelmed. But you're not so overwhelmed that you can't handle it. You're just slightly overwhelmed. And that is always the key, that you are in the process.
And part of that is part of working with that is how much can you relax into it? How much can you be at ease with that overwhelming inflow of energy?
Exactly. Exactly. Remember, this is a co-dynamic. You know, there's nothing like this in the world, you know. This is a co-dynamic. This is Mayavada Vedanta in application, and that has never been done before on this planet. And the Mahanirvana Tantra, which appeared about 1,000 years ago, was a rare written text, anticipated this. And the Mahanirvana Tantra, which is a document of Mayavada Vedanta, that is dualistic Vedanta, relational, co-dynamic, that document said, at the end of Kali Yuga, which is where we're living now, none of the old practices will work anymore. No prayers, no rituals, no systems, no philosophy. Even the supreme Vedanta, which had been the fountain, the flower and fountainhead of Asian mysticism, is passé. It's completely passé. The only thing that works is the Mayavada approach, and it is co-dynamic and relational. So you're co-dynamic with the earth, and that is the whole secret. The earth boosts you to a level where you can handle where it's boosting you to. That's the way the dynamic works. And so you put your faith in that process. And many people already feel and sense this process. I think that I'm just maybe giving some definition and direction to it. You know, role of the Nahual is to, you know, provide syntax. Well, there you go. Right.
Yes, and keep doing that for us, because that is very important. I very much appreciate that, as I'm sure everybody who's involved in this feels as well. Now, John, I want to get back into the time frame a bit more. But
right.
One thing you mentioned, the connection between the relation between Jupiter and the moon.
Right.
And you had mentioned to me a few nights ago also the connection between Jupiter and earthquakes.
Right.
And I believe we even have somewhere, if we can dig through our notes, find a YouTube link that kind of spells that out pretty well.
It does. We'll try to find that link again.
Okay.
That's probably too big of a topic to go into much now, but if you'd like to comment a bit on that,
just
would be
very briefly,
nice.
I want to
nice as well.
Point
okay.
out that
okay.
the astronomy that I'm following very closely is, again, not complicated. This astronomy, it's required, if I might use that term, to learn astronomy for the navigation experiment, okay? But it's required to learn, go read astronomy books and blah, 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 and black holes and string theory, or anything that's not observable. It's all naked eye, observable, voracious, testable astronomy. And the astronomy that's really important right now has to do with the retrogradation of the planet Jupiter. Now, we're in an extraordinary period from August 16th to September 14th, in which Jupiter is in one single degree of the zodiac. And that's because the planet Jupiter is going into its retrograde phase. It doesn't really go backwards. Retrograde means moving backwards against the sequence of the zodiac. It doesn't really go backwards, but it appears to, for the simple reason that the Earth, which is in an inner orbital track, moving faster than Jupiter, overtakes Jupiter. So just as like when you're on the highway and you pass another car and you overtake it in the passing lane, that car appears to drop back against the landscape, right?
Yes.
Well, Jupiter appears to drop back against the zodiac for 5 months of every year. And what is happening right now as we speak is that it is in the point where it stops. There's a point where it moves ahead, then it slows down, then it stops. That's called its station. It stops, and then on the 31st of August, it starts to reverse, and it reverses for 2.5 months, or for 5 months, actually. And at the midpoint of that period, which would be October 29th, the Earth passes Jupiter. It is conjunct. It is neck to neck with Jupiter. And you can actually observe all this. You can actually go out at night and watch Jupiter move backwards against the constellations. Now, this is what we're watching right now because it is an absolutely key maneuver in the correction of the divine Sophia, in the correction of the planetary mothership. And I've explained this at more length in the crew notes, why this is so important. We envision Jupiter as the tugboat, which has massive tow lines extended to the Earth. And on these massive tow lines, Jupiter is pulling the Earth into a position on its course where it can undergo self-propulsion. And there are three key moments when the mothership kicks into self-propulsion. One of them is August 31st. Second one is in October, early October, and the third one is in at the end of October. And by the end of October, being carefully towed into the right position by Jupiter, the tugboat, the mothership will be well underway on her own propulsion. Now, this is a nautical metaphor that I'm proposing in this experiment, Thomas, right? You can just call it a metaphor. The fantastic thing is, let's watch what happens while this metaphor unfolds. You know, are there going to be astronomical atmospheric phenomena? Are there going to be telluric changes, tectonic changes that would reflect this event? I am strongly convinced that there are. As a matter of fact, I would note this, that since August 16th, when Jupiter went stationary, as it's called, in other words, the tugboat just stopped. It's not going ahead or backward. Since August 16th, we've had remarkable events happening. A massive amount of tectonic earthquake activity all around the world, and numerous reports of groaning sounds and inexplicable noises either coming from the earth or the sky. And in some cases, for instance, the Ukraine report, if that proves to be valid, these sounds are very nautical. They sound like the things that you hear on the ocean if you've ever sailed on an ocean liner. I mean, it's staggering. Have you noted that?
Oh, indeed, indeed.
Particularly those sounds that were recorded in the Ukraine. I mean, they really sound like the noises that a massive sailing vessel makes when it's being towed around and when it's gearing up and gearing down with its engines in order to get ready to go into self-propulsion, you know? So I believe that the metaphor is something that we can observe and something we can verify by actual events. And then, of course, there is the inner psychic or collective aspect of that metaphor. But that's another subject that we'll say pick up in the next talk.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. And so, yes, and actually during that period, about August 16th, the week of around that time, we were getting hit with a lot of aftershocks again here. Well, I don't know if we should call them aftershocks. We're getting hit with, you know, 6.5 earthquakes and things on pretty much a daily basis here in Japan.
And elsewhere around the world.
Up right with that.
Yeah, I mean, there were quakes in Richmond, Virginia, and in the east of the United States, which is absolutely unheard of. There were quakes in Chile. There were quakes in Papua New Guinea. basically, there are quakes all over the earth. And I would interpret this, these quakes, to mean that it's the vibration coming from beneath deck. You know, if you've ever been on a massive ocean liner, even when it's the sea is very, very calm and it's moving slowly, there's a constant vibration that comes from beneath deck because the ocean liner is being propelled by these massive turbines. And you never, ever, when I left the United States when I was 19 and sailed to Tangiers, Africa, I'll never forget the 10 days on a Yugoslavian freighter. And there was never a moment when you didn't feel in the soles of your feet the vibration of the massive turbines of the boat. And this is exactly what we're starting to feel now. Those of us who are ready, willing, and able as crew to feel this are feeling it.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And so we're basically starting, this all begins, this time frame that we're referring to now, begins on March the 19th.
Right. It began on March the 19th, but the dynamics the critical events that determine her course correction have only been happening since the end of June. And that is when the tow lines were established between the Earth and Jupiter. Because Jupiter, the tug, is towing the Earth into her course correction. That's why I say the correction of Sophia begins in the apsides of Jupiter. This is a great, great mantra, but it's also a scientific proposition.
Okay, yeah, and we can see this in one aspect as being, a physical occurrence happening in the cosmos, in the solar system. But it's also her mental projection that this is her intent to use. She's not being used, but she wants to use Jupiter in this manner to be able to propel herself forward.
Exactly.
Like a launching, a push off in a sense.
That's exactly the picture, Thomas. And also I'd bear in mind that what some of us have been sensing during the month of August, those of you who've written me, and certainly I've felt it here in Andalusia, it's been an extremely tense month, especially the last half of the month. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Time seems to be very slow.
Mm-hmm.
There's a suspense in the air. And this is because, it's not because, but the way that I would describe this in the nautical metaphor is that it's the tension of the lines, the tow lines between the tugboat and the mothership have been very, very critical. And we will continue to feel this tension in the next 3 months as the mothership goes into self-propulsion. But at the same time, there are moments when we will also feel her surge when she tests her self-propulsion for the first time. And finally, I might add that one of the reasons why this process is so excruciatingly slow is because Sophia is taking extraordinary care with her correction. She knows exactly what she's doing. Don't have to believe me, just get to know the gal. She knows exactly what she's doing. And she wants, her intention is safe passage for the passengers and crew and for the cargo. And so she's taking meticulous care that the initial conditions of her correction would be set up properly.
So going as gingerly as she can.
Gingerly is a good word. Gingerly. She's going very, very carefully. She has all of our well-being in mind. She can't control the seas, my friends. She can't control the winds or the waters. There may be some difficult passages, especially when we go past the shoals of Cetus. That is at the moment at the end of October when the mothership actually sails past the satanic head of Cetus. We can expect there to be rough waters in the galactic slipstream. We can expect there to be wild winds in the rigging. But as far as the captain of the mothership is concerned, she is taking meticulous care for the safe passage of all human beings. No fear on this journey. There's no fear. There's only wonder. It's only wonder, awe, beauty, discovery. No fear. We sail with no fear.
Yeah, very important point. Yeah, there is no need for fear. It doesn't become involved in this equation in any sense at all.
No,
something we should get over.
There's no fear in this equation. There's no fear in this process. And any fear that you're feeling, a lot of the fear that you're feeling. I mean, there is some real fear because there's a lot of psychopathic predators and maniacs out there on the planet, and we haven't got around to taking them down yet. Although the time is near, my friend.
It's coming soon.
I'm drooling at the chops as I sit here and tell you this, you know. Mm-hmm. The time is near and the ritual is ready. The ritual is beautiful. The kill is ready. The ritual is ready. But apart from the fear of the interspecies predators, which you should be afraid of them because they're insane, murderous, and deceitful fiends, apart from that, the Archons are just throwing up a false fog of fear. You know, someone just on the crew just emailed me today. Oh, it turns out that Comet Elenin is fizzling out and it's not going to destroy the planet. Well, what a fucking relief. You know, I'm so tired of this Nibiru going to blow us.
Yeah.
Look at it this way, my friends. The Earth gives you life. If there's some comet or some blue dwarf or brown dwarf or a Groucho Marx planet smoking a cigar that's going to come in and hit the Earth and destroy us, well, die with the mother planet, you know. The mother planet, first of all, the mother planet isn't going to die. But die on the planet that gave you life and be happy that you ever had a chance to be here in the first place. But for God's sake, don't be afraid to die from a cosmic catastrophe, you know. That's just an archonic hoax. And it's terrible, and I'm so fed up and sick of this crap, you know, this Nibiru thing. And there's a planet coming into the solar system. And is it there? Is it not there? You know, forget it. The only planet that matters is the one we're sailing on. And if you're not connected with that, then you're a hopeless dog lost in a back lot.
Yeah. That really lines up with the thoughts I've been having recently with this, you know, 5.9 earthquake in the east coast of the States, and they're even putting out T-shirts now. You know, I survived the 5.9.
Well, you know,
in Japan, we survived
9.0.
I don't see one
single person
wearing
a T-shirt
anywhere.
Get on with it
and survive and enjoy life. You know,
there you go. You're in the ideal position. You have been tested in the fire. You're in the ideal position to prove that what applies for earthquakes in Japan applies for the whole planet, you know. If there's some cosmic catastrophe coming and the dirty, miserable, cowardly, murderous, deceiving, child-murdering skunks want to go hide in their holes and in their hideaways that they built for themselves, will go bury themselves and entomb themselves there. Or if they want to get off the planet, then get the hell off the planet and leave us alone. But I am very happy to be alive on this planet, and I'm very happy to die on this planet. She's not going to die. She's a long way from dying. She's a very vital, very young girl. She's 23 and a half years old, and she ain't going to die for a very long time. So if the human race has to get wiped out by a cosmic catastrophe, she can bring us back in a New York minute. She's done it before. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's look at the facts here, folks. Let's look at what's really the truth between the Earth and us and forget about all this fear-mongering and this ridiculous. I mean, don't we see now in the wake of 9/11 that it's just a con? It's a con to take away our freedom and to turn us into slaves. Fear has no place in this journey.
Yeah, we've seen ample proof of her autopoietic abilities, so let's trust them and get on with the show. Get on with the what's going on. It's extremely exciting.
And in that spirit, Thomas, since we have about 10 minutes left, I'd like to try something and offer something, and I haven't done before.
Okay.
It's kind of like, I don't necessarily like to use this term, but let's say a group visualization. I want you to visualize something with me, okay? I'm going to give you an imaginative picture of something. And I'm just going to plant this in your minds. I don't know how it will work out, but we'll see. I'd like to describe for you what the mothership actually looks like. Now, before I do that, I would like to suggest to all crew members and other people who are listening to this that You know, the Earth is not flat, okay? I think most of you would agree on that. Well, neither is the solar system, you know? So how come every picture of the solar system we've ever seen is flat? And how come even the pictures of the galaxy are flat? You know, I mean, I have to admit that I've played into this scheme, because when I present pictures of the Milky Way galaxy or the Andromeda galaxy on MetaHistory.org, what you see is a flat lenticular structure, a massive lenticular structure with spiral arms and a central hub or core. But recently I sent out a short clip in the crew notes that contains beautiful images of Medusa or jellyfish. I don't know if you watched that clip.
Yes.
I think it's in an aquarium, because there's one point where you see people in the background. Nonetheless, look at these beautiful creatures. These creatures, the galaxy is much more like a jellyfish than a flat lenticular flywheel of an automobile. Okay? So, we have to realize that the orbits of the planets around the sun and the motion of the galaxy itself consists of helices, or unraveling spirals, H-E-L-I-C-E-S, helixes. I think it's the plural of the word helixes. Helixes, or unraveling spirals. So it's not only as if you have a jellyfish, but you a pulsing jellyfish. The galaxy is like a pulsing jellyfish. You can actually hear the sound, pulsation it makes. It sounds like a drum beat. But it's also a twirling, pulsing jellyfish. So it's twirling, and so its tentacles twirl. And those tentacles are the extensions and projections and emanations of the pleuromic experiments into the infinite reaches of cosmic space and time. And along each of those tendrils, there are many, many, many worlds developing, many planetary systems. And in each of those planetary systems, the same structure of the pulsating jellyfish-like tendrils swirling repeats itself. So as a matter of fact, if you want to visualize the solar system, it's not just a flat mechanical system. There's the sun, and relatively in the same plane, these planets are circulating around the sun. All the planetary orbits are pulled into helices or spirals by the proper motion of the sun. And I calculated recently, I have to recalculate this, but I calculated recently that the length of the spiral relative to the width of the twirl is about 3.5 times. So in other words, if the solar system was 1 foot in diameter, it would be 3.5 feet long. It would be a jellyfish-type spiral 3.5 feet long. Okay? Can you visualize that?
Okay. I can visualize.
So these visualizations are so fantastic, my friend. They're so fantastic because they can really liberate us out of the archontic paradigm of the rigid bands of the planetary system. We don't live in a rigidly banded, restricted planetary system of clockwork mechanics. We don't really live in such a world. It's an archontic con. We live in a lenticular, Medusa-like, pulsing, living, tentacular, spiral world of planets and stars. That is the reality of it. And whether or not you like astronomy and physics, or whether or not you can get your mind around those concepts, I think that visualization can be accessible to everyone. It's a tremendously important thing to let your imagination go into that visualization if you can. If you can do that, do it.
Would you like to go into a little bit more of that? Kind of go into the structure of the mothership herself, some of the functions, or some of the, how would you say it, the tools, in a sense, that she's equipped herself with.
Absolutely. I'd love to do that. And it's the first time I've ever done this. So this is another exclusive for Grok to Talk. Okay?
Fantastic.
So we'll take the last 5 or so, or 10 or so minutes in order to do this.
Okay.
If you get on board the overall visualization that the Milky Way spiral galaxy is more like a jellyfish, and that the planetary system in which we inhabit is one nodule on one of the tendrils that is spiraling and twirling around this dancing, pulsating jellyfish. Get that general picture on board. Naturally then, since we're on the mothership, we've got our feet on deck, we see from the mothership, we look out, we see the environment of the solar galactic arms, the spiral arms. It's like a great, great river. Imagine it like the Mississippi River or the Amazon, the spiral arm.
Mm-hmm.
She's coming around the curve of a river. And as you look down, you can, if you look down on the solar system, you can sort of see that, the sun in the center and the Earth coming around this curve. So it's naturally a tendency when we place ourselves in this picture, in this imaginative exercise, we naturally want to ask, well, what does the mothership herself actually look like? Now, what is she shaped like? What is this boat we're on, this craft, this vessel, what is she shaped like? So I propose to you this visualization. Basic shape of the hull of the mothership is a lemniscate.
A lemniscate. Okay, what is that?
Lemniscate is like a figure eight. It's like the figure eight, which is an infinity symbol. But one section of it is much longer than the other. So the lemniscate has a long section, which is in the shape of a teardrop. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then the second part of the lemniscate, or the second, the lower part, the lower deck, as we'll call it, is another loop, but it's smaller and fatter.
Hmm.
The body of some spiders actually resembles a lemniscate. The lemniscate is the natural form that will be traced on the wall of a house outside, on the exterior wall of a house, if you set up a certain kind of sundial that allows you to project the position of the sun onto that wall through the course of the year. Depending on what latitude you're on, go research this on Google. Depending on what latitude you're on, the shape of the lemniscate will vary. But basically, the lemniscate that you can trace on a wall, exterior wall, projected from a sundial, will show you 6 months of the year is one loop. And that will be the larger loop if you're in the northern hemisphere. And the other 6 months of the year will be the smaller loop, because there is less sunlight in the northern hemisphere in the second half of the year. So you got that picture?
Mm-hmm.
That's what a lemniscate is. So a lemniscate is an elongated figure eight with the upper part or upper deck narrow and long, and the lower deck shorter and wider. The mothership has a hull shaped like a lemniscate. The fore part of the hull is the longer part, and it has a glass bottom. The hind part of the hull, I guess you'd call it the poop deck, or the rear hull, is shorter and is wider, and that's where cargo and ballast are stored. So the ballast is in the lower part of the hull. The upper part of the hull is basically lighter and looser. Now, I mentioned before a very strange property of the mothership. Sometimes I think I'm really crazy when I say these things, you know. But what is crazy? Crazy like who, you know? Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Her rudder is front rigged. So the rudder of the mothership is actually at the front end of the long part of the lemniscate. And the helm, which is the steering wheel where you control the rudder, is located at the joint between the upper deck, which is the long part of the lemniscate, and the lower deck, which is the lower deck is the front long part of the lemniscate, excuse me. And the upper deck mm-hmm. is the short, wide part of the lemniscate. And if the okay. narrow waist of the mothership, can you picture the narrow waist between those two sections of the hull?
Sure, kind of the crossover point on this figure eight-ish figure.
Yeah. Exactly. At the waist is where the helm is located. So the helm is located okay. at the waist, and the steering wheel, which is actually, as I said, a steering yoke, it's not a wheel, it's like a yoke of a video game or an airplane, is located at that point between the long lower hull, lower deck, and the short upper deck. The rudder is front mounted. Got that picture so far?
Yes, very clearly.
Okay, now I'll describe the rest of the structure of the mothership in just a few minutes, because we're around, I think we can go to 1:10. We're around 1:03 right now, Thomas.
Yeah, I think we've got another 5 minutes or 6 minutes.
Remember that the mothership is a steam sail vessel. She has two modes of power. So she has steam engines. These steam engines are the volcanic tectonic system of the planet. Steam comes out of volcanoes. The steam of the volcanoes and the steam of the entire system of tectonic plates, the steam produced by the magma that leaks out between these plates, is her propulsion system, but it's only part of it. She steams along through the spiral arms with that system, but she also sails in the winds of the spiral arms. So she has a rigging and a set of sails, and that is the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the empty atmosphere of the air. It's the atmosphere insofar as it is charged with electricity and plasma. We know that at any particular time on Earth, there are from anywhere to 350 to 750 violent thunderstorms on the Earth. Violent thunder and lightning storms. And so that system of the atmosphere, the air, the oxygen, which is a highly flammable gas, the nitrogen, the components of the atmosphere electrically charged into a plasma, that's her sails. So she is a sail steamer. And we're going to learn and experience and verify in real time how she actually navigates by both these systems. As I said, she's engaging the steam system for the first time on August 31st in 2 days, and then again on October 6th, and then again on October 31st. The other aspects of the mothership that I have yet to understand, because I'm just like you on this journey, I'm also learning and discovering the fantastic and awesome reality of this planet. And there are parts of the mothership that I can only describe to you, but I don't know yet how they work. One of them is ballast. I don't know exactly what her ballast is. Ballast, how would you define ballast, Thomas? It's a nautical term, but I think generally people know what it is.
Yeah, ballast is the weight that you either add to or throw overboard to change directions.
Okay, so she has some kind of ballast. I don't know what her ballast is yet. Maybe it's a good part of the human race, and she would throw them overboard.
I was just going to say that. Maybe it's shooting a couple of these nasty politicians out into space.
I can't say I would be disappointed if that was her ballast, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of some of that dead weight of these human beings who are absolutely
disappointed. They do have a useful function after all.
Yeah, they
That's
do.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, right. Well, they're better off dead than alive. We'll talk a little bit later. So anyway, mm-hmm. and the other thing, and this is most fascinating, is what are her gyroscopes? What are her gyroscopes? Now, I'm going to just venture something as a preview to the future. I'm not going to exactly make a prediction, but I'm going to say, I think we would be wise to observe that if this metaphor is real and testable, if the planet Earth is really assuming self-propulsion, and as she does so, you're going to see a massive change in the Coriolis effect.
Mm.
Because the Coriolis effect, in my initial understanding, now I have to go a lot deeper into this, And my initial understanding is that the Coriolis effect would be the expression of her gyrostatic machines. And everything on Earth is subject to the Coriolis effect. When you, the next time you go and flush the toilet, take a look, my friends. You know, does it go down mm-hmm. counterclockwise or clockwise? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it goes down one way in the northern hemisphere and another way in the southern hemisphere. And at the equator, it doesn't go down in a spiral at all. It just goes down without spiraling. Did you know that?
Yes, I'd heard that. I've never actually seen it.
Because
yeah.
there is no Coriolis effect at the equator. So if you're on a boat in the equator and you flush the toilet, it just goes down all sides at once. It doesn't spiral down. So I'm saying that the first thing we want to look for to track propulsion and observe propulsion is anomalous phenomena reported around the world regarding the Coriolis effect. And that has something to do with her gyroscopes and her gyrostatic machines. I don't know exactly what, but let's observe it.
Fascinating, fascinating. So each one of those terms and topics that you brought up is something that can be explored in greater detail, obviously. This is kind of an outline of how people can pursue these topics on their own as well.
Exactly, exactly. It's a preview of what we're going to be looking at in great detail as correction unfolds. And as we're in the second now, we're in the second of correction, there's only 10.
Uh-huh.
We're counting down. We counted down 9. We're in 8 and counting.
So we're in the second half of the second, yeah.
That's right. We're in the second. I think the third second begins sometime in October.
That'd be in October.
Yeah, that's right.
Very nice. Well, John, we're down to our final, literal final seconds here. I just want to throw one thing out before we sign off.
Sure.
And that is, people are familiar with the RIM site that has been supplied up on metahistory.org. I'm wondering if the kind of the parallel to that, the coastlining lesson that you had sent on a few months ago to a few of us, will that be made available in the near future?
It should be, because the coastlining okay. is a result of my 30 years of naked eye sky watching. You can buy astronomy books, go ahead, buy charts, look at charts. I'm telling you, if you have this one single coastlining chart in your hand, you can follow exactly what's happening in the sky, and you can not feel lost when I refer to, say, the Earth overtaking the planet Jupiter on October 31st. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about, and you can go out and look at it. And that you can do with coastlining. So what I'm going to do is some crew members have volunteered to frame up the crew notes in a beautiful form, and I'm going to ask them if they would also make the coastlining material available. And then in the next crew notes, I'll send out the URL so that everyone can access that.
Okay, fantastic. Fantastic. I look forward to that. Very good, John. Well, boy, we've covered quite a few things today. And we will pick things up here, if we stay on schedule, in 2 days from right from now.
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday.
When Jupiter goes retrograde. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, Tom. Okay, thanks
John.
So much.
Thank you very much, and let's sign off for tonight, and I'll talk to you in 2 days.
Sure.
Good night.